Head bonked something and I opened my eyes. Jack Cantori was kneeling to my left, his face tight and scared. It was Wireman in front of me, on his feet but bending over, shaking me like a daiquiri. The doll was lying face down on my lap. I batted her aside with a grunt of disgust. Oh, you nasty man indeed. Naveen landed in the pile of dead wasps with a papery rustle. Suddenly the places she'd taken me began to come back. Hell's own tour. The path to Shade Beach that Adriana Eastlake had called, much to her father's fury, Drunkard's Boulevard. The beach itself and the horrible things that had happened there. The pool, the cistern.
His eyes are open, Jack said.
Thank God, Edgar, do you hear me?
Yes, I said. My voice was hoarse from screaming. I wanted food, but first I wanted to pour something down my burning throat.
Thirsty. Can you help a brother out?
Wireman handed me one of the big bottles of Evian water. I shook my head.
Pepsi.
You sure, muchacho? Water might be.
Pepsi. Caffeine.
That wasn't the only reason, but it would do. Wireman put the Evian back and gave me a Pepsi. It was warm, but I chugged half of it, burped, then drank again. I looked around and saw only my friends in a length of dirty hallway. That was not good. In fact, it was terrible. My hand, I was definitely back to one again, was stiff and throbbing, as if I had been using it steadily for at least 2 hours. So where were the drawings? I was terrified that without the drawings, everything would fade the way dreams do upon waking. And I had risked more than my life for that information. I had risked my sanity. I struggled, trying to get to my feet. A bolt of pain went through my head where I'd bumped it against the wall.
Where are the pictures? Please tell me there are pictures.
Relax, muchacho. Right here.
Wireman stepped aside and showed me a semi-tidy stack of artisan sheets.
You were drawing like a madman, tearing them off your pad as you went. I took them and stacked them up.
All right, good. I need to eat. I'm starving.
And this felt like the literal truth. Jack looked around uneasily. The front corridor, which had been filled with afternoon light when I took Naveen from Jack and went bye-bye down a black hole, was now dimmer. Not dark, not yet. And when I looked up, I could see the sky overhead was still blue, but it was clear that the afternoon was either gone or almost gone.
What time is it? I asked.
5:15, Wireman said.
He didn't have to glance at his watch, which told me he'd been keeping close track.
Sunset's still a couple of hours away, give or take, so if they only come out at night...
I think they do. That's enough time, and I still need to eat. We can get out of this ruin. We're done with the house. We may need a ladder, though.
Wireman raised his eyebrows but didn't ask. He only said,
If there is one, it's probably in the barn, which seems to have stood up to Father Time pretty well, actually.
What about the doll? Jack asked. Naveen.
Put her back in Elizabeth's heart box and bring her along, I said.
She deserves a place at El Palacio, with the rest of Elizabeth's things.
What's our next stop, Edgar?
Wireman asked.
I'll show you, but one thing first.
I pointed to the gun in his belt.
That thing's still loaded, right?
Absolutely. Fresh clip.
If the heron comes back, I still want you to shoot it. Make it a priority.
Why?
Because it's her, I said. Percy's been using it to watch us.
2. We left the ruin the way we'd entered it, and found a Florida early evening full of clear light. The sky above was cloudless. The sun cast a brilliant silver sheen across the gulf. In another hour or so, that track would begin to tarnish and turn to gold, but not yet. We trudged along the remains of Drunkard's Boulevard, Jack carrying the picnic basket, Wireman the bag containing the food and the artisan pads. I had my drawings. Sea oats whispered at our pants legs. Our shadows trailed long behind us toward the wreck of the mansion. Far ahead, a pelican saw a fish, folded its wings, and dropped like a dive bomber. We did not see the heron, nor were we visited by Charlie the lawn jockey. But when we reached the crest of the ridge, where the path had once sloped down along dunes that were now eroded and steep, we saw something else. We saw the Percy. She lay at anchor 300 yards out. Her spotless sails were furled.
She rolled from side to side on the swell, ticking like a clock. From here we could read the entire name painted on her starboard side. Persephone. She appeared deserted, and I was sure she was. In the daytime, the dead stayed dead. But Percy wasn't dead. Worse luck for us.
My God, it could have sailed right out of your paintings, Jack breathed.
There was a stone bench to the right of the path, barely visible for the bushes growing around it and the vines snaking over its flat seat. He dropped onto it, gaping out at the boat.
No, I said, I painted the truth. You're seeing the mask it wears in the daytime.
Wireman stood beside Jack, shading his eyes against the sun. Then he turned to me.
Do they see it over on Don Pedro?
They don't, do they?
Maybe some do, I said.
The terminally ill, the schizos currently ditching their medicine.
That made me think of Tom.
But it's here for us, not them. We're meant to leave Duma Key on it tonight. The road will be closed to us once the sun goes down. The living dead may be all out there on Persephone, but there are things in the jungle. Some, like the lawn jockey, are things that Elizabeth created as a little girl. There are others that have come since Percy woke up again. I paused. I didn't like to say the rest, but I did. I had to. I imagine I'm responsible for some of those. Every man has his nightmares. I thought of the skeleton arms reaching up in the moonlight.
So, Wireman said harshly, the plan is for us to leave by boat, is it?
Yes.
Press gang, like in jolly old England?
Pretty much.
I can't do that, Jack said. I get seasick.
I smiled and sat down beside him.
Sea voyages aren't in the plan, Jack.
Good. Can you open that chicken for me and tear me off a leg? He did as I asked, and they watched, fascinated, as I devoured first one leg, then the other. I asked if anyone wanted the breast, and when they both said no, I ate that, too. Halfway through it, I thought of my daughter lying pale and dead in Rhode Island. I kept on eating, doing it methodically, wiping my greasy hands on my jeans between bites. Ilsa would have understood. Not Pam, and probably not Lynn, but Illy?
Yes.
I was frightened of what lay ahead, but I knew Percy was frightened, too. If she hadn't been, she would not have tried so hard to keep us out. On the contrary, she would have welcomed us in.
Time's wasting, muchacho, Wireman said. Daylight fleets.
I know, I said. And my daughter's dead forever. I'm still starving, though. Is there anything sweet? Cake? Cookies? A motherfucking ho-ho?
There wasn't.
I settled for another Pepsi and a few cucumber strips dipped in ranch dressing, which to me has always looked and tasted like slightly sweetened snot. At least my headache was fading. The images that had come to me in the dark, the ones that had been waiting all those years inside Naveen's rag-stuffed head, were also fading. But I had my own pictures to refresh them. I wiped my hands a final time and put the stack of torn and wrinkled sheets on my lap. The family album from hell. "Keep an eye out for that heron," I told Wireman. He looked around, glanced at the deserted ship ticking back and forth out there on the mild swell, then looked back at me.
"Wouldn't the spear pistol be better for Big Bird, with one of the silver harpoons attached?"
"No. The heron's something she just rides, the way a man rides a horse. She'd probably like it if we wasted one of the silver tips on it. But Percy is done getting what she likes." I smiled without humor. That part of the lady's career is over. 3. Wireman made Jack get up so he could strip the vines from the bench. Then we sat there, three unlikely warriors, two in their 50s and one barely out of his teens, overlooking the Gulf of Mexico on one side and a ruined mansion on the other. The red basket and mostly depleted food bag were at our feet. I thought I had 20 minutes to tell them what I knew, even half an hour, and that would still leave enough time. I hoped.
"Elizabeth's connection with Percy was closer than mine," I said, "much more intense than mine. I don't know how she stood it. Once she had the china figure, she saw everything, whether she was there or not, and she drew everything. But the worst pictures she burned before she left this place."
"Like the picture of the hurricane?" Wireman asked.
"Yes.
I think she was afraid of their power, and she was right to be afraid. But she saw it all, and the doll stored it all up, like a psychic camera. In most cases, I just saw what Elizabeth saw and drew what Elizabeth drew. Do you understand that? They both nodded. Start with this path, which was once a road. It went from Shade Beach to the barn. I pointed to the long vine-coated outbuilding where I hoped we would find a ladder. I don't think the bootlegger who wore it into the corral was Dave Davis, but I'm confident he was one of Davis's business associates, and that a fair amount of hooch came onto the Florida Suncoast by way of Duma Key. From Shade Beach to John Eastlake's barn, then across to the mainland. Mostly top-shelf stuff headed for a couple of jazz clubs in Sarasota and Venice, stored as a favor to Davis. Wireman glanced at the declining sun, then at his watch. Does this have any bearing on our current situation, muchacho? I assume it does. You bet. I produced a drawing of a keg with a fat screw-lid bung on top. The word table had been sketched in a semicircle on the side, with Scotland below it in another semicircle. It was ragged work. I drew far better than I printed. Whiskey, gents. Jack indicated a vague humanoid scribble on the keg between table and Scotland. The figure had been executed in orange, and one foot was raised behind it. Who's the chick in the dress? That's not a dress, it's a kilt. It's supposed to be a Highlander. Wireman raised his shaggy brows. Won't win any awards for that one, muchacho. Elizabeth put Percy in some sort of midget whiskey barrel, Jack mused. Or maybe it was Elizabeth and Nan Melda. I shook my head. Just Elizabeth. How big was this thing? I held my hands about 2 feet from each other, considered, then moved them a little farther apart. Jack nodded, but he was frowning, too. She put the china figure in and screwed the cap back on, or put the plug in the jug, and drowned Percy to sleep. Which seems fucked up to me, boss. She was underwater when she started calling to Elizabeth, for God's sake. On the bottom of the gulf. Leave that for now. I put the sketch of the whiskey barrel on the bottom of the stack and showed them the next one. It was Nan Melda, using the telephone in the parlor. There was something furtive about the tilt of her head and the hunch of her shoulders. Only a quick stroke or two, but it said all that needed to be said about how Southern folk felt back in 1927 about black housekeepers using the parlor phone, even in an emergency. We thought Addie and Emery read about it in the paper and came back, but the Atlanta papers probably didn't even cover the drowning of two little girls in Florida. When Nan Melda was sure the twins were missing, she called Eastlake, the mister, on the mainland to give him the bad news. Then she called where Addie was staying with her new husband. Wireman pounded his fist on his leg. Addie told her nanny where she was staying. Of course she did. I nodded. The newlyweds had to have caught a train that very night because they were home before dark the next day. By then the two middle daughters must have been home too, Jack said. Yep, the whole family, I said. And the water out there. I gestured toward where the slim white ship rode at anchor, waiting for dark. It was covered with small boats. The hunt for the bodies went on for at least 3 days, although they all knew those girls had to be dead. I imagine the last thing on John Eastlake's mind was trying to figure out how his eldest daughter and her husband got the news. All he could think about during those days was his lost twins. "They are gone," Wireman murmured. "Pobre hombre." I held up the next picture. Here were three people standing on the veranda of Heron's Roost, waving, as a big old touring car motored down the crushed shell driveway, toward the stone posts and the sane world beyond. I had sketched in a scattering of palms and some banana trees, but no hedge. The hedge did not exist in 1927. In the rear window of the touring car, two small white ovals were looking back. I touched each in turn. "Maria and Hannah," I said. Going back to the Braden School. Jack said, "That's a little cold, don't you think?" I shook my head. "I don't, actually. Children don't mourn like adults." Jack nodded. "Yeah, I guess. But I'm surprised." He fell silent. "What?" I asked. "What surprises you?" "That Percy let them go," Jack said. "She didn't, not really. They were only going to Bradenton. Wireman tapped the sketch. Where's Elizabeth in this?
Everywhere, I said. We're looking through her eyes.
4. There's not much more, but the rest is pretty bad. I showed them the next sketch. It was as hurried as the other ones, and the male figure in it was depicted back too. But I had no doubt it was the living version of the thing that had clamped a manacle on my wrist in the kitchen of Big Pink. We were looking down on him. Jack looked from the picture to Shade Beach, now eroded to a mere strip, then back to the picture. Finally, he looked at me.
Here?
He asked in a low voice. The point of view in this one is from right here.
Yes.
That's Emery, Wireman said, touching the figure. His voice was even lower than Jack's. Sweat had sprung up on his brow.
Yes.
The thing that was in your house?
Yes.
He moved his finger. And those are Tessie and Laura?
Tessie and Lolo, yes.
They, what, lured him in? Like sirens in one of those old Greek fairy tales?
Yes.
This really happened, Jack said, as if to get the sense of it.
It really did, I agreed. Never doubt her strength.
Wireman looked toward the sun, which was nearer the horizon than ever. Its track had begun to tarnish at last.
Then finish up, muchacho, quick as you can, so we can do our business and get the hell out of here.
I don't have much more to tell you anyway, I said. I shuffled through a number of sketches that were little more than vague scribbles. The real heroine was Nan Melda, and we don't even know her last name. I showed them one of the half-finished sketches. Nan Melda, recognizable by the kerchief around her head and a perfunctory dash of color across the brow and one cheek, talking to a young woman in the front hallway. Naveen was propped nearby on a table that was nothing but 6 or 8 lines with a quick oval shape to bind them together. Here she is, telling Adriana some tall tale about Emery after he disappeared, that he was called suddenly back to Atlanta, that he went to Tampa to get a surprise wedding present, I don't know. Anything to keep Addie in the house, or at least close by.
Nan Melda was playing for time, Jack said.
It was all she could do. I pointed toward the crowding jungle overgrowth between us and the north end of the quay, growth that had no business being there, not at least without a team of horticulturalists working overtime to provide its upkeep. All that wasn't there in 1927, but Elizabeth was here, and she was at the peak of her talents. I don't think anyone trying to use that road that went off-island would have stood a chance. God knows what Percy had made Elizabeth draw into existence between here and the drawbridge.
Adriana was supposed to be next?
Wireman asked. Then John, Maria, and Hannah after them. Because Percy meant to have all of them except, maybe, Elizabeth herself. Nan Melda must have known she could only hold Addie a single day, but a day was all she needed. I showed them another picture. Although much more hurried, it was once again Nan Melda and Libet standing in the shallow end of the pool. Naveen lay on the edge with one rag arm trailing in the water. And beside Naveen, sitting on its fat belly, was a wide-mouthed ceramic keg with table printed on the side in a semicircle. Nan Melda told Libet what she had to do. And she told Libet she had to do it no matter what she saw in her head or how loud Percy screamed for her to stop, because she would scream, Nan Melda said, if she found out. She said they'd just have to hope Percy found out too late to make any difference. And then Nan Melda said, I stopped. The track of the lowering sun was growing brighter and brighter. I had to go on, but it was hard now. It was very, very hard.
What, muchacho?
Wireman said gently.
What did she say?
She said that she might scream too, and Addie, and her daddy. But she couldn't stop. Dasn't stop, child, she said. Dasn't stop, or it's all for nothing. As if of its own accord, my hand plucked the Venus Black from my pocket and scrawled 2 words beneath the primitive drawing of the girl and the woman in the swimming pool. Dasn't stop. My eyes blurred with tears. I dropped the pencil into the sea oats and wiped the tears away. So far as I know, that pencil is still where I dropped it. Edgar, what about the silver-tipped harpoons? Jack asked. You never said anything about them.
There weren't any magic goddamn harpoons, I said tiredly. They must have come years later when Eastlake and Elizabeth returned to Doom McKee. God knows which of them got the idea, and whichever one it was may not have even been completely sure why it seemed important. But Jack was frowning again. If they didn't have the silver harpoons in 1927, then how?
No silver harpoons, Jack, but plenty of water.
I still don't follow that.
Percy came from the water. She's of water.
He looked at the ship as if to make sure it was still there.
It was.
Right, but at the pool, her hold slipped. Elizabeth knew it, but didn't understand the implications. Why would she? She was just a child.
Oh, fuck,
Wireman said. He slapped his forehead.
The swimming pool. Fresh water. It was a freshwater pool, fresh as opposed to salt.
I pointed a finger at him. Wireman touched the picture I'd drawn of the ceramic keg sitting beside the doll.
This keg was empty? Which they filled from the pool?
I have no doubt. I shuffled the swimming pool sketch aside and showed them the next one. The perspective was again from almost exactly where we were sitting. Above the horizon, a just-risen sickle moon shone between the masts of a rotting ship I hoped I would never have to draw again. And on the beach, at the edge of the water.
Christ, that's awful, Wireman said. I can't even see it clearly, and it's still awful.
My right arm was itching, throbbing, burning. I reached down and touched the picture with the hand I hoped I would never have to see again, although I was afraid I might. I can see it for all of us, I said. How to draw a picture. 11. Don't quit until the picture's complete. I can't tell you if that's the cardinal rule of art or not. I'm no teacher, but I believe those six words sum up all I've been trying to tell you. Talent is a wonderful thing, but it won't carry a quitter. And there always comes a time, if the work is sincere, if it comes from that magic place where thought, memory, and emotion all merge, where you will want to quit. When you will think that if you put your pencil down, your eye will dull, your memory will lapse, and the pain will end. I know all this from the last picture I drew that day, the one of the gathering on the beach. It was only a sketch, but I think that when you're mapping hell, a sketch is all you need. I started with Adriana. All day long she had been frantic about M, her emotions ranging from wild anger at him to fear for him. It has even crossed her mind that Daddy has done something rash, although that seems unlikely. His grief has made him torpid and unresponsive ever since the search ended. When sunset comes and there's still no sign of M, you'd think she'd become more nervous than ever. But instead she grows calm, almost cheerful. She tells Nan Melda that M will be back directly. She's sure of it. She feels it in her bones and hears it in her head where it sounds like a small chiming bell. She supposes that bell is what they mean by woman's intuition, and you don't become fully aware of it until you're married. She tells Nanny this, too. Nan Melda nods and smiles, but she watches Addie narrowly. She's been watching her all day. The girl's man is gone for good. Libet has told her this, and Melda believes her. But Melda also believes that the rest of the family may be saved. That she herself may be saved. Much, however, depends on Libet herself. Nan Melda goes up to check on her remaining babian, touching the bracelets on her left arm as she climbs the stairs. The silver bracelets are from her mama, and Melda wears them to church every Sunday. Perhaps that's why she took them from her special things box today, slipping them on and pushing them up until they stuck on the swell of her forearm, instead of letting them dangle loose above her wrist. Perhaps she wanted to feel a little closer to her mama, to borrow a little of mama's quiet strength, or perhaps she just wanted the association of something holy. Libet is in her room drawing. She's drawing her family. Tessie and Lolo very much included. The eight of them, Nan Melda is also family as far as Libet is concerned, stand on the beach where they have spent so many happy times swimming and picnicking and building sandcastles, their hands linked like paper dolls and great big smiles running off the sides of their faces. It's as if she thinks she can draw them back to life and happiness by the pure force of her will. Nanmelda could almost believe it possible. The child is powerful. Recreating life, however, is beyond her. Recreating life is even beyond the thing from the Gulf. Nanmelda's eyes drift to Libet's special things box before going back to Libet herself again. She has only seen the figurine that came from the Gulf once, a tiny woman in a faded pink wrap that might once have been scarlet, and a hood from which hair spills, hiding her brow. She asks Libet if everything is all right. It's all she dares to say, as far as she dares to go. If there really is a third eye hidden under the curls of the thing in the box, a far-seeing mojo eye, it is impossible to be too careful. Libet says, "Good. I just draw in, Nanmelda." Has she forgotten what she's supposed to do? Nanmelda can only hope she hasn't. She has to go back downstairs now and keep an eye on Addie. Her man will be calling for her soon. Part of her cannot believe this is happening. Part of her feels as if her whole life has been a preparation for it. Melda says, "You may hear me call your daddy. If I do, you want to go pick up those things you left by the pool. Don't leave them out all night for the dew to get at." Still drawing, not looking up. But then she says something that gladdens Melda's frightened heart. "No'm. I'll take Percy. Then I won't be scared if it's dark." Melda says, "You take whoever you want, just bring in Noveen. She's still out there." It's all she has time for, all she dares when she thinks about that special probing mojo eye and how it might be trying to see inside her head. Melda touches her bracelets again as she goes downstairs. She is very glad she had them on while she was in Libet's room, even though the little China woman was put away in the tin box. She is just in time to see the swirl of Addie's dress at the end of the back hall as Addie turns into the kitchen. It is time. This is going to play out. Instead of following Addie into the kitchen, Melda runs down the front hall to the mister's study where, for the first time in the 7 years she's worked for the family, she enters without knocking. The mister is sitting behind his desk with his tie off and his collar undone and his braces hanging down in slack loops. He has the folding gold-framed pictures of Tessie and Lolo in his hands. He looks up at her, his eyes red in a face that is already thinner. He doesn't seem surprised that his housekeeper should come bursting in unannounced. He has the air of a man beyond surprise, beyond shock. But of course this will turn out not to be so. He says, "What is it, Melda Lou?" She says, "You got to come right away." He looks at her from his streaming eyes with a calm and infuriating stupidity. "Come where?" She says, "To the beach and bring that there." She points to the harpoon pistol, which hangs on the wall along with several short harpoons. The tips are steel, not silver, and the shafts are heavy. She knows. Hasn't she carried them in the basket enough times? He says, "What are you talking about?" She says, "I can't be taking time to explain. You got to come to the beach right now lest you want to lose another one." He goes. He doesn't ask which daughter or inquire again why he should want the harpoon pistol. He just snatches it off the wall, takes two of the harpoons in his other hand, and strides out through the open study door, first beside Melda and then ahead of her. By the time he reaches the kitchen, where Melda has last seen Addie, he's at a full-out run, and she is falling behind even though she's running herself, holding her skirts before her in both hands. And is she surprised by this sudden break in his torpor, this sudden galvanizing action? No, because despite the blanket of his grief, the mister has also known that something here is wrong, and going wronger all the time. The back door stands open. An evening breeze frisks in, stirring it back even farther on its hinges. Only now it's actually a night breeze. Sunset is dying. There will still be light on Shade Beach, but here at Heron's Roost, dark has already come. Melda dashes across the back porch and sees the mister already on the path to the beach. He's only a shadow. She looks around for Libet, but of course she doesn't see her. If Libet is doing what she is supposed to be doing, then she is already on her way to the swimming pool with her heart box under her arm. The heart box with the monster inside it. She runs after the mister and catches him at the bench where the path drops down to the beach. He is standing there frozen. In the west, the last of the sunset is a sullen orange line that will soon be gone, but there is enough light for her to see Addie at the edge of the water and the man who is waiting to greet her.
Adriana screams, "Emery!" She sounds mad with joy, as if he's been gone a year instead of a day. Melda shouts, "No, Addie, keep away from him," from beside the frozen, gaping man, but she knows Addie will pay no attention, and she doesn't. Addie runs to her husband. John Eastlake says, "What?" And that's all. He's broken free of his torpor long enough to run this far, but now he's frozen again. Is it because he sees the two other forms, farther out but also wading toward shore, wading in water that should be over their heads? Melda thinks not. She thinks he is still staring at his oldest daughter as the dim figure of the man coming out of the water reaches for her with his dripping arms and lays hold of her neck with his dripping hands, first choking off her glad cries and then dragging her into the surge. Out there in the gulf, waiting, ticking back and forth on the mild swell like a clock that tells time in years and centuries rather than minutes and hours, is the black hulk of Percy's ship. Melda grabs the mister's arm, sinking her hand deep into the bicep, and speaks to him as she has never spoken to a white man in her life. She says, "Give a help, you son of a bitch, for he drowns her." She yanks him forward. He comes. She doesn't wait to see if he keeps on or freezes up again, and she's forgotten all about Libet. All she can think about is Addie. She has to stop the Emery thing from dragging her into the water, and she has to do it before the dead Babians can get there to help him. She cries, "Turn loose! Turn loose of her!" Flying down the beach with her skirt belling out behind, Emery has got Addie in almost up to her waist. Addie is now fighting, but she's also choking. Melda flounders toward them and throws herself on the pallid corpse who has his wife by the throat. He screams when Melda's left arm, the one with the bracelets on it, touches him. It is a bubbling sound, as if his throat is full of water. He writhes in Melda's grip like a fish, and she rakes him with her fingernails. Flesh sloughs away beneath them with sickening ease, but no blood flows from the pale wounds. His eyes roll in their sockets, and they are like the eyes of a dead carp in the moonlight. He pushes Adriana away so he can grapple with the harpy that has attacked him, the harpy with the cold, repelling fire on its arm. Addie wails, "No, Nanny, stop! You're hurting him!" Addie flounders forward to pull Melda off, or at least to separate them. And that's the moment when John Eastlake, standing shin-deep in the gulf, fires the harpoon pistol. The triple-bladed bit takes his oldest daughter high in the throat, and she stands bolt upright, with 2 inches of steel poking out in front of her and 4 more jutting out behind, just below the base of her skull. John Eastlake shrieks, "Addie! No! Addie! I didn't mean to!" Addie turns toward the sound of her father's voice and actually begins to walk toward him, and that is all Nan Melda has time to see. Addie's dead husband is trying to tear itself free of her grip, but she doesn't want to let it go. She wants to end its terrible half-life, and perhaps by doing so warn off the 2 baby horrors before they can get too close. And she thinks, so far as she can think, that she can do that, because she has seen a smoldering scorch mark on the thing's pale, wet cheek and understands that her bracelet has made it. Her silver bracelet. The thing reaches for her, its wrinkled mouth yawning in what might either be fear or fury. Behind her, John Eastlake is screaming his daughter's name over and over. Melda snarls, "You done this." And when the Emery thing seizes her, she lets it. "You and the bitch been running you," she would add. But its white hands close on her throat as they closed on poor Addie's, and she can only gurgle. Her left arm is free, however. The one with the bracelets on it, and that arm feels very powerful. She draws it back and swings it forward in a great arc, connecting with the right side of the Emery thing's head. The result is spectacular. The creature's skull caves in under the blow, as if a little immersion had turned that hard cage to candy. But it's still hard, all right. One of the shards that comes poking through the mat of Emery's hair slashes her forearm deep, and blood goes pattering down into the water that surges around them. 2 shadows pass her, one on her left, one on her right. Lolo cries, "Daddy!" in her new silver voice. Tessie cries, "Daddy, help us!" The Emery thing is trying to get away from Melda now, floundering and splashing, wanting no more to do with her. Melda jabs the thumb of her powerful left hand in its right eye, feeling something cold, like toad guts under a rock, come squishing out. Then she whirls around, staggering as the rip tries to pull her feet from under her. She reaches out with her left hand and seizes Lolo by the scruff of her neck and pulls her backward.
"You ain't,"
she grunts, and Lolo comes flailing with a cry of surprise and agony. And no cry like that ever came from no little girl's throat, Melda knows. John howls, "Melda, stop it!" He's kneeling in the last thin run of the surf with Addie before him. The harpoon's shaft juts up from her throat.
"Melda, leave my girls alone!"
She has no time to listen, although she spares a thought for Libet. Why has Libet not drowned the China figure, or did it not work? Has the thing Libet calls Percy stopped her somehow? Melda knows it's all too possible. Libet is powerful, but Libet is still only a child. No time to think of that. She reaches out for the other undead, for Tessie, but her right hand isn't like her left. There's no silver to guard it. And Tessie turns with a snarl and bites. Melda is aware of thin, shooting pain, but not that two fingers and part of a third have been bitten off and now float in the water beside the pallid child. There's too much adrenaline whipping through her for that. Over the top of the hill where the bootleggers sometimes tote pallets laden with liquor, a small sickle moon rises, casting further thin radiance on this nightmare. By its light, Melda sees Tessie turn back to her father, sees Tessie hold out her arms again.
"Daddy! Daddy, please help us! Nan, Melda's gone crazy!"
Melda doesn't think. She reaches across her body and seizes the child by hair she has washed and braided 1,000 times. John Eastlake screams, "Melda, no!" Then, as he picks up the dropped harpoon pistol and casts about on the sand near his dead daughter's body for the remaining shaft, another voice calls. This one comes from behind Melda, from the ship anchored out there on the Caldo. It says, "You should never have interfered with me." Melda, still holding the Tessie thing by the hair, it fights, it kicks, but she's hardly aware of it. Spins clumsily in the water and sees her, standing at the rail of her ship in her cloak of red. Her hood is down, and Melda sees she is not even close to human. She is something other, something beyond human understanding. In the moonlight, her face is ghastly and full of knowing. Rising from the water, thin skeleton arms salute her. The breeze blows apart the snakes of her hair. Melda sees the third eye in Percy's forehead, sees it seeing her, and all will to resist is snuffed out in an instant. At that moment, however, the head of the bitch goddess snaps around as if she has heard something, or someone tiptoeing up behind her. She cries, "What?" And then,
"No! Put that down, put it down! You can't do that!"
But apparently Libet can, and has. Because the shape of the thing at the ship's rail wavers, turns watery, and then becomes nothing but moonlight. The skeleton arms slither back beneath the water and are gone. The Emery thing is gone, too. Disappeared. But the twins shriek together in shared pain and desolation at their abandonment. Melda cries to the mister, "It gonna be all right!" She turns the one she's had by the hair loose. She doesn't think it will want anything to do with the living, not now, not for a while. She cries,
"Libet's done it, she—"
John Eastlake shrieks,
"Get your hands off my daughters, you bad nigger!"
And he fires the harpoon pistol for the second time. Do you see it strike home, piercing Nan Melda through? If so, the picture is complete. Ah, God, the picture is complete. 20. Percy. 1. The picture, not the last full-blown Edgar Fremantle work of art, but the second to last, showed John Eastlake kneeling on Shade Beach with his dead daughter beside him and the sickle moon just risen above the horizon behind him. Nan Melda stood thigh-deep in the water with one little girl on either side of her. Their damp, upturned faces were drawn long in expressions of terror and rage. The shaft of one of those short harpoons protruded from between the woman's breasts. Her hands were clasped upon it as she looked unbelievingly at the man whose daughters she had tried so hard to protect, the man who'd called her a bad nigger before taking her life. "He screamed," I said. "He screamed until his nose bled, until he bled from one eye. It's a wonder he didn't scream himself into a cerebral hemorrhage." There's no one on the ship, Jack said. Not in this drawing, at least.
No, Percy was gone. What Nan Melda hoped for actually happened. The business on the beach distracted the bitch just long enough for Libet to take care of her, to drown her to sleep.
I tapped Nan Melda's left arm where I had drawn two quick arcs and made one tiny crisscross to indicate the reflection of weak moonlight. And mostly because something told her to put on a mother's silver bracelets. Silver, like a certain candlestick. I looked at Wireman. So maybe there is something on the bright side of the equation, looking out for us a little. He nodded, then pointed to the sun. In another moment or two, it would touch the horizon, and the track of light beating across to us, now yellow, would deepen to pure gold.
But dark is when the bad things come out to play. Where is the China Percy now? Any idea where it ended up after all this on the beach?
I don't know exactly what happened after Eastlake killed Nan Melda, but I've got the general gist. Elizabeth. I shrugged. She'd shot her bolt, at least for a while. Hit overload. Her father must have heard her screaming, and that's probably the only thing that could still bring him around. He must have remembered that no matter how awful things were, he still had a live daughter at Heron's Roost. He might even have remembered that he had two more 30 or 40 miles away, which left him with a mess to clean up. Jack pointed silently at the horizon where the sun was now touching.
I know, Jack, but we're closer than you think.
I shuffled the last sheet of paper to the top of the pile. It was the barest of sketches, but there was no mistaking that knowing smile. It was Charlie, the lawn jockey. I got to my feet and turned them away from the gulf and the waiting ship, which was now silhouetted black against gold.
Do you see it?
I asked them.
I saw it on our way up from the house. The real jockey statue. I mean, not the projection we saw on our way in.
They looked.
I don't, Wireman said, and I think I would if it was there, muchacho. I know the grass is high, but that red cap should still stand out, unless it's in one of the banana groves.
Got it, Jack cried and actually laughed.
The fuck you do, Wireman said, stung.
Then, where?
Behind the tennis court.
Wireman looked there, started to say he still didn't see it, then stopped.
I'll be a son of a bitch, he said. The Christing thing's upside down, isn't it?
Yes, and since it has no actual feet to stick up, that's the square iron base you see. Charlie marks the spot, amigos. But first we need to go to the barn.
2.
I had no premonition of what was waiting for us inside the long, overgrown outbuilding, which was dark and stifling hot, and no idea that Wireman had drawn the Desert Eagle automatic until it went off. The doors were the kind that slide open on tracks, but these would never slide again. They were rusted in place 8 feet apart, and had been for decades. Gray-green Spanish moss dangled down like a curtain, obscuring the top of the gap between the doors. What we're looking for... I began, and that was when the heron came flapping out with its blue eyes blazing, its long neck stretched forward and its yellow beak snapping. It was getting itself into flight as soon as it cleared the doors, and I had no doubt that its target was my eyes. Then the Desert Eagle roared, and the bird's mad blue glare disappeared along with the rest of its head in a fine spray of blood. It hit me, light as a bundle of wires wrapped around a hollow core, then dropped at my feet. At the same instant, I heard a high, silver scream of fury in my head. It wasn't just me, either. Wireman winced. Jack dropped the handles of the picnic basket and jammed the heels of his hands against his ears. Then it was gone.
One dead heron, Wireman said, his voice not quite steady.
He prodded the bundle of feathers, then flipped it off my boots.
For God's sake, don't tell Fish and Wildlife. Shooting one of these will probably cost me $50,000 and 5 years in jail.
How did you know? I asked.
He shrugged. What does it matter? You told me to shoot it if I saw it. You Lone Ranger, me Tonto.
But you had the gun out.
I had what Nan Melda might have called an intuition when she was putting on her mama's silver bracelets,
Wireman said, unsmiling.
Something's keeping an eye on us, all right. Leave it at that. And after what happened to your daughter, I'd say we're owed a little help. But we have to do our part. Just keep your shooting iron handy while we do it, I said.
Oh, you can count on that.
And Jack, can you figure out how to load the spear gun?
No problem there. We were a go for spear gun.
3. The interior of the barn was dark, and not just because the ridge of land between us and the gulf cut off the direct light of the setting sun. There was still plenty of light in the sky, and there were plenty of cracks and chinks in the slate roof, but the vines had overgrown them. What light did enter from above was green and deep and untrustworthy. The outbuilding's central area was empty save for an ancient tractor sitting wheelless on the massive stumps of its axles. But in one of the equipment stalls, the light of our powerful flashlight picked out a few rusty, leftover tools and a wooden ladder leaning against the back wall. It was filthy and depressingly short. Jack tried climbing it while Wireman trained the light on him. He bounced up and down on the second rung, and we heard a warning creak.
Stop bouncing on it and set it out by the door, I said. It's a ladder, not a trampoline.
I don't know, he said. Florida's not the ideal climate for preserving wooden ladders.
Beggars can't be choosers, Wireman said.
Jack picked it up, grimacing at the dust and dead insects that showered down from the 6 filthy steps.
Easy for you to say. You won't be the one climbing on it. Not at your weight.
I'm the marksman of the group, Nino, Wireman said. Each to his own job. He was striving for airy, but he sounded strained and looked tired.
Where are the rest of the ceramic keglets, Edgar? Because I'm not seeing them.
Maybe in back, I said.
I was right. There were perhaps 10 of the ceramic table whiskey keglets at the very back of the outbuilding. I say perhaps because it was hard to tell. They had been smashed to bits.
4. Surrounding the bigger chunks of white ceramic and mixed in with them were glittering heaps and sprays of glass. To the right of this pile were 2 old-fashioned wooden handcarts, both overturned. To the left, leaning against the wall, was a sledgehammer with a rusty business end and patches of moss growing up the handle.
Someone had a container-smashing party, Wireman said.
Who do you think, M?
Maybe, I said. Probably.
For the first time, I started to wonder if she was going to beat us after all. We had some daylight left, but less than I had expected, and far less than I was comfortable with. And now, in what were we going to drown her China simulacrum? A fucking Evian water bottle? It wasn't a bad idea, in a way. They were plastic, and according to the environmentalists, the damn things are going to last forever. But a China figure would never fit through the hole in the top.
So what's the fallback position? Wireman asked.
The gas tank of that old John Deere, will that do?
The thought of trying to drown Percy in the old tractor's gas tank made me cold all over. It was probably nothing but rusty lace.
No, I don't think that will work. He must have heard something close to panic in my voice because he gripped my arm.
Take it easy. We'll think of something.
Sure, but what?
We'll take her back up to Heron's Roost, that's all. There'll be something there.
But in my mind's eye, I kept seeing how the storms had dealt with the mansion that had once dominated this end of Duma Key, turning it into little more than a facade. Then I wondered how many containers we actually would find there, especially with just 40 minutes or so before dark came and the Percy sent a landing party to end our meddling. God, to have forgotten such an elementary item as a watertight container.
Fuck, I said.
I kicked a pile of shards and sent them flying.
Fuck!
Easy, Vato, that won't help.
No, it wouldn't.
And she'd like me angry, wouldn't she? The old angry Edgar would be easy to manipulate. I tried to get hold of myself, but the I can do this mantra wasn't working. Still, it was all I had. And what do you do when you can't use anger to fall back on? You admit the truth.
All right, I said, but I don't have a clue.
Relax, Edgar, Jack said, and he was smiling. That part's going to be okay.
Why, what do you mean?
Trust me on this, he said.
5.
As we stood looking at Charlie the lawn jockey in light that was now taking on a definite purple cast, a nonsense couplet from an old Dave Van Ronk blues occurred to me. Mama bought a chicken, thought it was a duck, sat it on a table with the legs sticking up. Charlie wasn't a chicken or a duck,
but his legs, ending not in shoes but in a dark iron pedestal, were indeed sticking up. His head, however, was gone. It had crashed down through a square of ancient moss and vine-covered boards.
"What's that, muchacho?" Wireman asked. "Do you know?"
"I'm pretty sure it's a cistern," I said. "I'm hoping not a septic tank."
Wireman shook his head. "He wouldn't have put them in a shit heap, no matter how bad his mental state was. Never in a million years."
Jack looked from Wireman to me, his young face full of horror.
"Adriana's down there? And the nanny?"
"Yes," I said. "I thought you understood that. But the most important thing is that Percy's down there. And the reason I think it's a cistern is, Elizabeth would have insisted on making sure the bitch was in a watery grave," Wireman said grimly. "A fresh watery one." 6. Charlie was heavy, and the boards covering the hole in the high grass were more rotten than the steps of the ladder. Of course they were. Unlike the ladder, the wooden cap had been directly exposed to the elements. We worked carefully in spite of the thickening shadows, not knowing how deep it was beneath. At last I was able to push the troublesome jockey far enough to one side so that Wireman and Jack could grab the slightly cocked blue legs. I stepped onto the rotted wooden cap in doing so. Someone had to, and I was the lightest. It bent under my weight, gave out a long warning groan, puffed up sour air.
"Get off it, Edgar!"
Wireman yelled, and at the same instant Jack cried, "Grab it! Oh, whore, it's gonna fall through!" They seized Charlie as I stepped off the sagging cap, Wireman around the bent knees and Jack around the waist. For a moment I thought it was going to drop through anyway, dragging them both along. Then they gave a combined shout of effort and tumbled over backward with the lawn jockey on top of them. Its grinning face and red cap were covered with huge lumbering beetles. Several dropped off onto Jack's straining face, and one fell directly into Wireman's mouth. He screamed, spat it out, and leaped to his feet, still spitting and rubbing his lips. Jack was beside him a moment later, dancing around him in a circle and brushing the bugs off his shirt.
"Water!" Wireman bellowed. "Give me the water! One of them got in my mouth! I can feel it crawling on my fucking tongue!"
"No water," I said, rummaging in the considerably depleted bag. Now on my knees, I could smell the air rising through the ragged hole in the cap far better than I wanted to. It was like air from a newly breached tomb, which, of course, it was. "Pepsi."
"Cheeseburger, cheeseburger, Pepsi," Jack said. "No Coke."
He laughed dazedly. I handed Wireman a can of soda. He stared at it unbelievingly for a moment, then raked back the pull tab. He took a mouthful, spat it out in a brown and foamy spray, took another, then spat that one out. The rest of the can he drank in 4 long swallows.
"Ay, caramba," he said. "You're a hard man, Van Gogh."
I was looking at Jack. "What do you think? Can we shift it?" Jack studied it, then fell on his knees and began to tear away the vines clinging to the sides.
"Yeah," he said, "but we gotta get rid of this shit." "We should have brought a crowbar," Wireman said.
He was still spitting. I didn't blame him.
"Wouldn't have helped, I don't think," Jack said. "The wood's too rotted. Help me, Wireman."
And when I fell on my knees beside him, "Don't bother, boss. This is a job for guys with 2 arms." I felt another flash of anger at that. The old anger was very close now, and quelled it as best I could. I watched them work their way around the circular cap, tearing away the vines and the weeds as the light faded from the sky. A single bird cruised by with its wings folded. It was upside down. You saw something like that and felt like checking into the nearest nut house, preferably for a long stay. The 2 of them worked opposite each other, and as Wireman neared the place where Jack had begun and Jack neared the place where Wireman had begun, I said, "Is that spear gun loaded, Jack?" He looked up.
"Yes, why?"
"Because this is going to be a photo finish, after all." 7. Jack and Wireman knelt on one side of the cap. I knelt on the other. Above us, the sky had deepened to an indigo that would soon be violet.
"My count," Wireman said. "Uno, dos, tres."
They pulled and I pushed as well as I could with my remaining arm. That was pretty well, because my remaining arm had grown strong during my months on Duma Key. For a moment the cap resisted, then it slid toward Wireman and Jack, revealing a crescent of darkness.
a black and welcoming smile. This thickened to a half moon, then a full circle. Jack stood up, so did Wireman. He was checking his hands for more bugs. I know how you feel, I said, but I don't think we have time for you to do a full delousing. Point taken, but unless you've chewed on one of those maricones, you don't know how I feel. Tell us what to do, boss, Jack said. He was looking uneasily into the pit, from which that sallow stench was still issuing.
Wireman, you have fired the spear gun, right?
Yes, at targets, with Miss Eastlake. Didn't I say I was the marksman of the group?
Then you're on guard, Jack. Shine that light.
I could see by his face that he didn't want to, but there was no choice. Until this was done, there'd be no going back. And if it wasn't done, there'd never be any going back. Not by the land route, at least.
He picked up the long-barreled flashlight, clicked it on, and shone the powerful beam down into the hole.
Ah, God, he whispered.
It was indeed a cistern lined with coral rock. But at some point during the last 80 years, the ground had shifted, a fissure had opened, probably at the very bottom, and the water inside had leaked out. What we saw in the flashlight's beam was a damp, moss-lined gullet, 8 or 10 feet deep, and about 5 feet in diameter. Lying at the bottom, entwined in an embrace that had lasted 80 years, were two skeletons dressed in rotten rags. Beetles crawled busily around them. Whitish toads, small boys, hopped on the bones. A harpoon lay beside one skeleton. The tip of the second harpoon was still buried in Nan Melda's yellowing spine. The light began to sway, because the young man holding it was swaying.
Don't you faint on us, Jack, I said sharply. That's an order.
I'm okay, boss.
But his eyes were huge, glassy, and behind the flashlight, still not quite steady in his hand, his face was parchment white.
Really?
Good. Shine it down there again. No, left. A little more. There. It was one of the table whiskey kegs, now little more than a hump under a heavy shag of moss. One of those white toads was crouched on it. It looked up at me, lids nictitating malevolently.
Wireman glanced at his watch. We have, I'm thinking, maybe 15 minutes before sundown. Could be a little more, could be less, so...
So Jack puts the ladder into the hole, and down I go.
Edgar, mi amigo, you have just one arm.
She took my daughter. She murdered Ilsa. You know this is my job.
All right.
Wireman looked at Jack.
Which leaves the watertight container question.
Don't worry, he said, then picked up the ladder and handed me the flash. Shine it down there, Edgar. I need both hands for what I'm doing. It seemed to take him forever to get the ladder placed to his satisfaction, but finally the feet were on the bottom, between the bones of Nan Melda's outstretched arm. I could still see the silver bracelets, although now overgrown with moss, and one of Addie's legs. The ladder was really very short, and the top rung was 2 feet below ground level. That was all right. Jack could steady me to begin with. I thought of asking him again about the container for the china figure, then didn't. He seemed completely at ease on that score, and I decided to trust him all the way. It was really too late to do otherwise. In my head, a voice, very low, almost meditative, said, "Stop now, and I'll let you go free."
"Never," I said.
Wireman looked at me without surprise.
You heard it too, huh?
8. I lay on my stomach and backed into the hole. Jack gripped my shoulders. Wireman stood beside him, with the loaded harpoon pistol in his hands and 3 extra silver tips stuck in his belt. Between them, the flashlight lay on the ground, spraying a bright light into the tangle of uprooted weeds and vines. The stench of the cistern was very strong, and I felt a tickling on my shin as something scurried up my leg. I should have tucked my pants cuffs into the tops of my boots, but it was a little late to go back and start over.
"You feel the ladder?" Jack asked. "Are you there yet?"
"No, I..." Then my foot touched the top rung.
"There it is. Hang on."
"I've got you, don't worry."
"Come down here, and I'll kill you."
"Go on and try," I said. "I'm coming for you, Birch, so take your best shot." I felt Jack's hands tighten spasmodically on my shoulders.
"Jesus, boss, are you
I'm sure. Just hold on." There were half dozen rungs on the ladder. Jack was able to hold onto my shoulders until I'd gotten down 3. Then I was chest deep.